Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your intrepid podcast host, and this is part two of my interview with Suzanne Stone, who for 38 years worked on Jeopardy. Now, if you missed part one, after you listen to this, go back and check that out. Suzanne, this week, shares the inner workings of this show that has really become part of the American lexicon. And she's a terrific guest. So, here's part two, or Double Jeopardy, with Suzanne Stone, this week on Hollywood and Levine. Is it shocking to you guys when occasionally there'll be, I saw one a few months ago where they asked them to identify this celebrity, and it was Robert Redford. It was a picture of Robert Redford, like in the Butch Cassidy years, okay? And not one contestant even rang in.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys sit in the office and are going, come on, you idiots. How can
like
you
that.
Not know that?
Something like that. But yeah, Robert Redford, that was a shocker that people did not recognize Robert Redford. So we learned something. Maybe a sociologist or a pop culture expert will have to, you know, investigate further people's perceptions of celebrity.
Now, when we watch at home, we have certain contestants that that we take a liking to and that we root for. You guys do that in the office too, or are you just too professional to do anything like that?
To be honest with you, I think Alex Trebek set the standard. He wanted everyone to succeed. And so we've always been rooting for the ones that are the underdogs. But of course, when you have someone like Ken Jennings evolve, or Matt Amodio, or our more recent contestant, Ryan, you're just like, you want to see this person succeed, but you always wonder, is there somebody out there that's going to knock them down? Or, you know, are they going to lose by a dollar? That's very possible. Are they going to flub up the double the Daily Double? And so, like I said, Alex set the standard that, you know, we have to be fair. We have to root for everybody. And I mean that truly. He was the type of a guy. He wanted everyone to enjoy the show and to have a good experience being a contestant on the show. And he was always very encouraging.
It has to be tough on contestants now because of social media that I'm sure they're not used to having strangers rip them because they don't like their outfit, you know, and you know, like Matea, who was a recent longtime champion, who I thought was darling and effervescent and really fun and everything. Oh, my God. People were just crushing her on social media. Oh, I don't like the way she flops her hands around, or I don't like how she answered that question. And it's got to be so much tougher for contestants now than in the past, because now you go on television and 200 people go, I hate her hairstyle. She looks awful. It's got to be tough for them.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's get into the contestant process. What is the contestant process?
Well, you know, my area was the actual game material. And so I was obviously friendly with the contestant coordinators, and they're my friends to this day. But the process, as anyone who goes on the Jeopardy website knows, there's a pretest now that we can, that they, anytime people can take that. And then if they pass that, they can take a real contestant test and be considered for, if they pass the test, to be considered as a contestant. So it's a process that happens with interviews, a test that I believe is still a 50 question test. And then if
how many do you have to get right? Do you know?
I believe, and I, because I don't know if things have changed, and it's always been something that, you know, we had to stay away from knowing anything about. We don't know the names of the people who,
sure,
who are contestants and everything. But I think if they get a 35 or above of the 50 clues, that's my understanding. And so they get interviewed by the contestant coordinators. Sometimes, you know, people come to Los Angeles to be interviewed and tested. And other times the contestant coordinators pre-pandemic would be traveling to different cities. And I believe now they do a lot of the interviewing and testing online. But I'm not sure, because obviously that's something that that department knows. So, yeah, they take a test. They are interviewed. And someone like Ken Jennings, you know, took the test, I believe, 11 times over years to try out, and finally was chosen as a contestant. And he made history.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are repeating.
He passed the test, though, I assume.
I assume.
He just didn't get past the screening process.
The test scores are kept secret. To my knowledge, they kept secret. I never knew the test, you know, the numbers on any of their contestants or anything.
The online tests must have many variations, because
yes,
what's to stop somebody from just taking screenshots of all of the questions and then going back and finding out the answers and then signing in as somebody else to take the
test? I don't know how what the security situation is, but, you know, that's their department. And, but yeah, there's the tests change over the months and years. And, you know, they have a very strong security situation, because they don't want people to steal information, you know, cheat. And, but, you know, these things happen in game shows too, where over the years you've heard stories about people using other people's social security numbers.
Sure.
Because there are rules depending on the standards and practice and the networks and the production companies, how many game shows a person can compete in. And, obviously there's federal rules, thanks to the 1950s game show scandals, which Robert Redford directed a movie about with
Quiz Show. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Quiz Show, very good movie with Rob Marr. Was that his name? I can't remember his name.
I'm sorry. No, that's wrong.
But he was in Northern Exposure.
Yeah, and it was Rob Morrow.
Yeah. And so that's based on a real story, you know, that's real life. And in fact, Doris
Rob Morrow for 400, Alex.
Yeah, that's right. One of our top American historians, Doris Kearns Goodwin, her husband, Dick Goodwin, was more or less the character that that Rob played, was someone who was involved in that those 50 scandals. And so that's why to this day there are strict rules and laws, federal laws, regarding how those shows can play.
So let's get into the actual production of the show.
Sure.
You shoot 5 shows a day. So when do you shoot those? How many production days do you have a month?
Usually about 3 weeks out of 4, we'll tape 2 days out of 5. So it's more or less 46 weeks, I believe, of taping if I'm not mistaken. My math may be off, but what it is, a typical week in tape season, which runs from usually August through May, is a Monday is, you know, day to last prepare the five games for the next day. And then Tuesday would be you're at the office by 7:30 in the morning. Alex would be there at 6:30 in the morning, already reading the games that were chosen by the standards and practice people, which is a third party organization. There's various companies that do that, that pick the games blindly out of envelopes. So reading through five games, 11 o'clock, any changes are made from a, you know, a morning meeting discussion with Alex and the producers and the head writers. And then 11 o'clock on the dot, start taping, usually finish in a half hour, the first game, a 10-minute turnaround. After three games, there's a meal break where the staff, crew, everybody has a meal. And then you do two more shows. And if you're lucky, you're going to be out of the by quarter to five. And that's 2 days a week, usually Tuesdays and Wednesdays. It may have changed over the years. And Thursday, Friday, those are days to recuperate and also to just keep preparing the next batch of games. Ideally, in the past, when we have our summer hiatus, we try to have five days of work, but we get vacation days, of course. But 100 games is the goal that are written and researched by the time we start taping in the August, early August.
Oh, that so you do your prep work. Yeah, do your prep work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And over the years, you know, sometimes, especially in those seasons where Rock and Roll Jeopardy would be in business or Sports Jeopardy, the people that was a smaller group within the group working on those shows, it would slow down some of the production of games. But then again, like I said, there's always a stockpile of evergreen categories, evergreen clues, and to create games or to patch up games, as we say, build categories, things like that. But that's after, you know, thankfully so many years of production of Jeopardy, there is material like that available. And then there's always going to be new material, like with an election year or the Oscars or when a big blockbuster movie happens or A Star is Born or something like that. You're going to have fresh material coming in.
More with Suzanne in a moment, but right now, a word about honey. Today's episode is brought to you by Honey, and of course, faithful listeners of this podcast know that Honey is a free browser extension that scours the internet for promo codes and applies the best ones it finds to your cart. Now, the key word in that last sentence was free. It works very easily. You're shopping online, you get to the checkout page, and the Honey button just drops down, and all you have to do is click Apply Coupons. Wait a couple of seconds, does its thing, and then it finds the promo codes that apply, and you find the total that you have to pay goes down and down and down and down. I used it just last week, and I saved $21.52 on art supplies for my cartooning. It really does work, and like I said, it's free. So if you don't already have Honey, well, you could straight up be missing out on free savings. It is literally free. It installs in a few seconds. You notice I say the word free a lot because, you know, all these other things, you got to buy stuff. This is free. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid and you'll be supporting this humble podcast. So get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/Levine. Once again, that's joinhoney.com/Levine. I'm not sure if I mentioned this or not in this commercial, but it's free. Okay, now back to Suzanne Stone and more Jeopardy. You mentioned that there is a third party that selects the categories.
Right.
But a lot of times you'll have categories that or at least the title of the categories will kind of run into each other, you know, where there'll be like a phrase.
Yeah, theme, you know, or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So that the theme will be, you know, three men and then the next one and a baby.
Correct.
Okay. So those two categories both have to be in the same game.
Right.
So that's indicated, like, you got to do these two categories at the same time.
It evolves. First off, the third party is the people that actually do the standards and practice overview of choosing games and being present on the set while the shows are taping, and they help with judgment calls if there's any problems. That's a third party. But what happens is the writers or the head writers will come up with a phrase and say, can we do a wordplay, you know, over three categories? Stephen Dorfman, like I mentioned, our late lamented writer, Stephen Dorfman, he did a whole board, and the word Napoleon appeared in each category. There's Napoleon, the famous emperor and warrior. There's Napoleon as in the dessert. There's Napoleon as in a literary character. There's several different ways you can play with
Napoleon
that.
Napoleon complex.
Yeah, yeah, Napoleon things. So he came up with a very clever board that it was kind of a hidden puzzle, you might say. He was great into puzzles and crosswords and wordplay and everything. So, you know, this could be a spontaneous outburst of creativity for one writer. They come up with something and then they'll go to the head writer and say, can I try this? And they say, sure, you know, and see what happens and see what the rest of the writers and the producers see with the final product before it's taped or accepted as a game.
Okay. So, as for the contestants themselves, so they, if they don't live in Los Angeles, have to fly out on their own dime, right?
Right.
And I guess they stay in a hotel, but they get reduced hotel rates.
I have no idea. I know Ken Jennings talked about staying in a hotel near the Sony studios. There's a lot of hotels and motels in that area because it is near LAX. And the Tournament of Champions participants will have their travel expenses covered by the show. That's my understanding now. But yeah, if you're, it's on your dime. If you want to come out and be a contestant on Jeopardy and they tell you, we'd love to see you on whatever date, you know, you're going to be slated to be here in Culver City. They do it. And I was told years ago by a contestant coordinator that it's the local people that are always late for the 8 a.m. call. You know, they think they can beat the freeways or something like that. But the out-of-towners will make sure that they're there because this is the turning point in their life and career to come and be a contestant on Jeopardy.
I understand that if you are a continuing champion like Ryan Long, who was recently on the show and lived in Philadelphia. So if you shoot a batch of shows and then there's going to be a two-week hiatus before you shoot again and he flies back to Philadelphia,
right. They
will pay for the flight.
I don't know.
Back and forth.
I don't know what the situation is.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think I read where that started with Ken Jennings, because Ken
Jennings
kept saying, you know what, this isn't worth it for me to keep flying back and forth on my own dime from Seattle.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of started that precedent. So you get a bunch of contestants show up at 8 o'clock in the morning. And at this point, I remember I was sitting once in the contestant section and they're just kind of picked at random as to which game they're going to be slotted in. Right?
I think so. I mean, like I said, I have to be, I'm not in the stage when the taping happens. I'm in the office watching on a monitor, but that's maybe the way. I know they come in with their garment bags or whatever of changes of clothes.
How many changes of clothes?
I think three, and the wardrobe people have scarves and sweaters and shirts and things like that. If a champion keeps running, you know, each game and they're going to change their clothes. And of course, Johnny Gilbert, our great announcer, will tell the audience when we've had audiences that, okay, we're now on day two and everyone's changed their clothes and we're going to pretend that it's the next day, but you know, it's just been 45 minutes. And this is a, you know, a revelation for a lot of people who've never seen a tape, game shows taping. They have no idea. They think that, in fact,
they come back every day.
And I would get phone calls from people saying, stop the show. Tell Alex that, you know, And of course, they're
it was filmed 2 months ago. Yeah.
That, and Alex is not doing a live show five nights a week, you know.
Right.
It just
And you guys do get burned sometimes, and they have to, like, run something where there was one, something about the Ukraine. And they put a crawl saying, this was filmed in January before the invasion. So
yeah, things like that do happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine they do. So if you're doing five shows and you're a champion, it seems to me that if you're going to beat a champion, probably the Thursday or Friday show is the time to get them, because they have to go through that pressure situation five straight times, and I'm sure they're a lot fresher for the Monday show than they are for the Friday show.
Right. And then there's lunch, you know, at the commissary, and you know, the joke is, you know, don't eat a turkey sandwich or anything because you're going to be sleepy afterwards. But it is, it's a grueling experience for these champs to be on their top of their game, and it goes fast, but it's still, it's very stressful. I've known a lot of the contestants have said that to you know, reporters and to our own publicists, that it is an effort. And after the break for lunch, and they eat, the contestants eat in separate tables than anyone else in the commissary that is from the staff or crew. So, you know, it is after lunch, you never know.
I was sitting in that contestant section, and they all had like fountain pens that they were using to like practice their buzzer skills.
Ah, yes. Yeah. And it is, you need that practice.
If you notice sometimes, if you're watching the show and the camera pulls back from the stage, there is this row right up front, people sitting with monitors and all. Who right. are all of those people and what do they do?
They're the producers and also they're judging the show. And so on their monitors, they're seeing what the board, and they're also seeing the clues. And so they're, and they've got their notes to take, but they have to watch, you know, obviously they're closer to watching a monitor than how many feet away the actual stage. So they're all the producers. They're keeping track of anything in the way of judgment calls, you know, also how people are betting, if there's any technical problems, things like that. They're literally on the front line of everything. So the producers are there. They're going to call the shots with the judgments if there's a mistake or a misunderstanding or something like that. So, yeah.
I was sitting, like I said, in that contestant section and looking over the shoulder of the person who had a monitor that recorded who buzzed in and when, you know, if they buzzed in too quickly,
yes,
or, you know, they buzzed in late. I was fascinated by that. I was like watching that more than I was actually watching the show, because that was fascinating to
yeah.
me, you know, because you don't know when somebody buzzes in. Was he the only one buzzing in, or did all three of them buzz in? Or
right.
is there one person who is just keeps buzzing in too early? I imagine
right.
when that happens during a break, someone comes out to them and says, hey, you're
right.
jumping the gun here.
The contestant coordinators want everyone to be relaxed, ready to go, play the game. enjoy themselves. And if they are too nervous and they buzz in too soon, they lock themselves out. They're only becoming their own worst enemy. So someone, you know, and Ken Jennings talked about it a lot. He practiced at home for months with a ballpoint pen, clickers or whatever, mm-hmm. and was standing there, not sitting watching the show, but standing just as you would in the real taping to replicate the experience. And he was better off for it.
So they don't get to buzz in until the host finishes the question.
Correct.
But there is somebody sitting in that front row or whatever who unlocks the the buzzers. I guess the key is syncing up with that guy.
Yeah.
You know, and if that guy changes, then you're sort of in trouble. If you kind of have the rhythm down where you sense his rhythm when he hits it versus the end of the host. So that's got to be a little weird. When I was there, I noticed that there were usually in each round three or four clues that Alex screwed up or mispronounced, whatever. And when they went to the commercial break, then Alex just redid them to make them perfect. I was floored by the amount of concentration that was required to host that show, to read those questions, to keep the game moving, to interact with the contestants and all. It seemed to me like, you know, that was so high pressure. And yet when they went to the commercial breaks, Alex would go up to the front and answer questions from the audience.
Right.
Instead of going like, okay, all right, give me 3 minutes. You know, is there an oxygen tent here?
That's right.
It was amazing to me how he would go and talk to the contestants, and then they go, 10 seconds, and he'd walk back and lights up, and there he goes. Amazing.
He did. He enjoyed talking to the audience. And of course, this happens with a lot. Same questions over and over again. His favorite movies. He was quite the movie buff of classic movies. Things they'd ask him about his hometown in Canada.
A lot of Canada questions.
Yeah, and very much a very proud Canadian. And so he wanted to do that. And not all TV hosts do that. I certainly have seen in my own experience of being in an audience where once the little segment's over, people walk away, light up a cigarette, they used to, and ignore the public that's there to, applaud. But not Alex. He really was out there to kid around with Johnny Gilbert. They were a great comedy team. And a lot of the audience was so thrilled to talk to him and ask his question about his favorite movie, which was How Green Was My Valley? And his favorite movie star was Basil Rathbone, things like that. So, he was so professional and such a good man. And we miss him so much.
And Johnny Gilbert, what, 96 now?
He may be 96.
Amazing.
I don't know if he admits to anything, but we have over the years tried to research his true birth date and everything. And he is an amazing, positive attitude professional. And he does a great job with the show. And yes, he's quite the announcer and does a great job.
Now, to me, one of the greatest jobs ever is to be one of those people on the Clue crew. Those guys, they get to fly around the world and do questions. I'm standing in Sweden here.
Yeah.
You know, this is Gustav somebody. what was he for? How many people apply for that job? Like 200,000?
I don't know the exact number, but when that was announced back in 2001, I believe, is when the Clue Crew started. There was a room full of videotapes, boxes and boxes of resumes, videotapes, things like that, for people applying for the job. And over the years, we've had, I don't know currently how many, I'd have to think about it, how many people were in the Clue Crew over the years. But, you know, so, you know, but yeah, you always had those, I'm standing in front of, you know, Buckingham Palace, or I'm flying a plane above, you know, whatever, and adding to the show.
Yeah.
What a, it out of its,
what a good gig
yeah.
that was.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that shows when Alex was running them would end, your taping day would end at around 4 o'clock. That was not the case, though, when you had that series of guest hosts.
That's my understanding. I wasn't there.
I understand.
I was working at home because of the pandemic. So I knew that there were long tape days depending on, you know, it's a tougher job than people realize.
Sure.
Alex made it look so easy and it was so smoothly running all those years. So here you have professional broadcasters coming in and doing the show, and it's tough. And so they were longer days.
Yeah. And some of them were better than others. Is the vibe different on the set when Ken Jennings is hosting versus Mayim Bialik?
I don't know, since I wasn't there watching, but I know the people on the staff like both of them and are, you know, I think everyone was relieved that they both could share the podium after Alex's passing. But no, the vibe seems to be equally divided. My friends and family tell me they like both of them. And I, you know, and I had, like I said, I have no idea who will be the final solo host. That's up to the executive producers and the people behind the scenes. But as far as vibe, I think both of them, having seen both of them in action on their other shows and things like that, both professional, and they both obviously are used to hard work, because it is hard work to do to be a host on a game show.
Okay, final question. You had 4 super champions this year. Is that a fluke, or do you think there's some reason for that?
I think it's a fluke. After all the years, you know, in 84, starting the show, and it wasn't until 2004, 20 years later, that Ken Jennings showed up. And by that time, the rule had changed about not retiring a champ after 5 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have him for many, many years be the reigning champion for longevity. And then to finally have someone like James Holzhauer and the other champs that came afterwards, Matt Amodio and Amy Schneider. I don't know if it has to do with the internet and, you know, casting a wider net to get contestants, or the fact that Jeopardy is part of our American culture and more people, you know, it's embedded in our lives, that say, hey kid, you want to be a Jeopardy champion, you got to start now. And, you know, 10 years later, these kids are out there ready to go and play the game in real life. It is amazing how we've gotten these super champions, but, and I'm sure there's a graph somewhere somebody's made of how, from 84 to now 2022, where, you know, these people stack up and how it happened. Maybe it's something in the water or the pollution or global warming. I have no idea.
You know, it's the Alex Trebek stage. That's
yes.
the difference. It's the yes. Alex Trebek maybe. Stage.
He hovers around. His name certainly is mentioned every day. And his career, you know, he was obviously a broadcaster for many, many years, starting in his 20s in Canada. But he came to the States in 73 and started with game shows and everything. And I told him, I thought he would write a different kind of an autobiography, but by the time his illness came and he wanted to really have a legacy of advice and wisdom and things. And, you know, he had a long life, very successful, and he gave back to everybody. And to this day, I think Jeopardy wants to continue that that legacy.
Well, it certainly has become part of the American fabric.
Yes. And
it's one of our few remaining shared experiences.
Yes.
That everybody will watch the show in real time because they want to know whether or not Ryan Long is going to survive
right.
another day and that sort of thing. Suzanne, right. this has been great. Thank you so much. We
My
don't
pleasure.
Have any parting gifts for you.
Oh.
But, you know, I do have an old Merv Griffin album. That,
oh, boy.
Yeah, I can
I have
send to
come,
you.
Some Rice-A-Roni, I think, in my kitchen, but it's not from Jeopardy. And yeah, this has been great. And I'm glad I could help clarify a few things. But, you know, the mysterious world of game shows, there is a lot of security involved in creating a show like this. And, of course, there'll be other game shows coming. But Jeopardy established such a standard, and I was very fortunate to be part of it.
Yeah. It's a show for smart people.
Yay!
And we're in a world with so many dumb fucks that it's lovely to have a show for smart people. Thank you, Suzanne.
You're welcome.
There you go. Now you know all there is to know about Jeopardy. Our thanks to Suzanne Stone, also to Adam and Susie Meister Butler, along with John Wolfert, Howard Hoffman, Bruce, and Jason Miller. My email address, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. I am on Instagram. I can't believe you're not following me yet on Instagram. Come on, I showcase my cartoons. Hollywood and Levine, Instagram. I want to get 2 million people by the end of the month. And I have, I think, 1,200 now. So I need to ask you people to step it up a little bit. Also, I'm on Twitter at Ken Levine. Okay, that'll do it for this week. We will see you next week right here on
Hollywood and Levine.